the United States is one of the most dangerous high-income countries in the world in which to give birth, with more than 1,200 women and other birthing people dying from complications associated with pregnancy or childbirth as of last year. This is ridiculous. I'm going to put it out there. That is not an opinion. In my view, that is a fact. That's ridiculous that we are living in 2022 and there are still women dying in childbirth or not getting the prenatal care that they should get. It's crazy to me. As a mom myself, prenatal care and the delivery process and postnatal care was so essential. And it is hard to swallow and imagine that there are women out there who are not getting the care that they deserve to bring their children into the world safely and to take care of themselves. So we're going to talk a little bit about this morning, because as much as we all think we live in a first world country, this to me sounds like a third world problem happening here in the United States. Joining me now is Monique Shaw. She is a senior program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is the nation's largest health philanthropy group. And I'm very excited to talk to Monique this morning. Thank you for being here, Monique. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Melissa, so much for having me.
Of course. I mean, talk to us if you don't mind, Monique. Are you shocked personally? I mean, for the work that you do, does it shock you that we still have over 1,000 women or so having complications per year because of pregnancy? I mean, that to me is just startling in the United States.
It's absolutely shocking. You know, although this is a decades long crisis, and so this problem is not new. And this maternal and child health crisis in the United States, while not new, it also disproportionately affects people of color, who account for nearly 60% of all maternal deaths. It is also affecting undocumented and incarcerated women, people that are experiencing intimate partner violence, and also our LGBTQ+ population as well.
Why is that happening for those particular populations? Because you're right. I have a very good friend of mine, actually, who is Black, and she and I had talked about our first pregnancies, and I was a high-risk pregnancy. Didn't know I was going to be, but it was. And so was she. Both of us had experienced near-death experiences, and she said she actually lost a cousin to childbirth, and she almost lost her sister to childbirth. And so I have noticed that especially some other populations struggle with this more than others. Why is that?
Yeah, so I'm so sorry to hear about your experiences. I, too, lost an aunt to childbirth.
I
intimately know how this impacts people. You know, but there are many factors and causes related to this crisis, but a few key root causes include our inequitable health system in the United States. We also see structural racism and discrimination in healthcare settings, and also really a lack of investment in maternal and child care. Our nation's medical and public health systems are ill-equipped to deal with the magnitude of this crisis, but it's not due to the lack of resources, but failures to adequately and equitably allocate those resources.
So I guess I just don't understand. How is that possible that we have a maternal mortality crisis that's disproportionately affecting people of color? Like, how is that happening?
Yeah, you know, compared to white women, Black women are almost twice as likely to lack health insurance. They're twice as likely to have unexpected and serious problems with labor and delivery, and are three times as likely to die from pregnancy-related issues. We also see similar experiences with Indigenous women in our country, particularly those that are in rural areas, because they are at a heightened risk of life-threatening complications during or following childbirth. And so there are really just many challenges as it relates to access to care, access to quality care, and also the type of care that's being delivered.
So would you just to, I don't mean to beat a dead horse. I just want to understand it a little bit better. Is it because you've got women who are denied very good health care? Is it because they live too far from clinics? Is this a trickle down effect? They don't have good enough working jobs that they can afford to have the health care and the care that they should be getting? Like, what are some of the attributing factors to why they're being denied the same care that white women are being given?
Yeah, again, it is a lack of access to healthcare providers that reflect, you know, your own identities. It is, you know, distance to those healthcare providers. You know, Medicaid pays for more than 40% of births in the United States and 65% of births to Black mothers in the U.S. And so there are birthing people that don't have access to insurance and access to the appropriate providers to be able to deliver a respectful care.
Is this an issue in other countries, Monique?
It is an issue in other countries. However, as you noted, the U.S. is one of the most dangerous high-income countries in the world in which to give birth. And we had over 1,200 women and other birthing people die from pregnancy and childbirth-related complications last year alone.
That's insane. So what can be done, Monique Shaw? What do you and the group at Robert Wood Johnson Foundation suggest our country should be doing to fix this problem?
That's such an important question, because while this is a decades-long problem, the good news is that over 80% of these deaths are preventable. And so there are many different solutions that can be employed. Predominantly, Congress not only has an opportunity but a moral imperative before its session ends this year to prioritize maternal and child health, and they can do that in a couple of really important ways. The first is by supporting and encouraging states to expand Medicaid. The second is to swiftly enact the Black Maternal Health Momnibus Act, which contains more than $1 billion for expanding the perinatal workforce. It helps to strengthen maternal health equity programs and research initiatives, and also improves telehealth services. The bill also makes significant investments in other areas that are directly connected to maternal health, things like housing, nutrition, and also transportation.
Well, we so appreciate you even just bringing the topic to our audience here. Monique Shaw, Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the nation's largest health philanthropy. And we're so glad that we can at least talk about this situation, and hopefully we see changes very soon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, Monique Shaw here on WICC. So you all know I'm a big Disney fan, and lately it's kind of hard to overlook the fact that Disney is just not doing as great as it used to in the box office. Now, that doesn't really include all the Marvel movies per se, but like their animated films, what Disney is known for at the core, just doesn't seem to be doing as well as it used to do. And so what's going on? Why do Disney animated movies keep bombing at the box office? For some perspective this morning, we're talking to Dr. Andrew Draper. He co-hosts a podcast. It's called Off Script Film Review, the home of bold cinema. Dr. Draper, thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Dr. Draper, I have to ask you, and it's okay if the answer is I'm not a fan. Do you like Disney at all?
Yeah, I'm a big Disney fan.
So what do you think is going on? Why are we seeing some of these recent animated films? But like Lightyear, which is based on, it's like a prequel to Toy Story, which is one of the most popular high-grossing Pixar films of all time. Why did that do so poorly? I think it lost like $100 million overall.
Right. Well, there's a lot of factors to consider. There's a lot going on. You have to consider the pandemic and just the movie going habits changed. There's a lot more competition in the animated space with Illumination or DreamWorks. And also corporate decision making between the changing of CEOs from Bob Iger to Bob Chapek and now actually back to Bob Iger. And so all these things are affecting the bottom line of the animated films.
Do you think what's going on at the corporate level for Disney is impacting this generation's parents? Not the kids so much, but like my generation, the millennials, the Gen Xers, if you will, who grew up with Disney. And this is what we did for our birthday parties. You went to go see these movies in the theaters. I remember going to The Lion King in theaters. Like, that's what you did growing up. And now maybe there's kind of a bad taste in people's mouths because Disney has even changed politically in the way that they see things.
That might affect some parents, but at the same time, there's very successful Disney films that have kind of more progressive storylines and characters that don't really have that issue and are still successful. So that might affect some people's decision, but it's only a small part, I think.
So I have to confess, I have not seen this movie, Strange World, but it just registered as one of the worst opening weekends for Disney in the modern era. That's the one that is on track to lose about $100 million overall. Why? I don't know if you've seen the movie.
No, I haven't. And part of the reason I haven't is I didn't even really know it was coming out or what it was. It seems to have been this big marketing failure. I've talked to some other big Disney fans, and they had no idea that it was coming out either. It's also coming out against, you know, four or five big releases over the Thanksgiving holiday. So it's got a lot of competition, and even some, it's kind of Disney fighting with itself because Black Panther, Wakanda Forever is still out as well. So that's kind of a conflict of interest there too.
So we're talking this morning with Dr. Draper. Dr. Andrew Draper is a co-host for the podcast Off Script Film Review, the home of bold cinema. And we're talking about why Disney animated films seem to be flopping recently at the box office. Do you think they'll make a comeback, Dr. Draper?
I think they can absolutely make a comeback, but they're going to have to work pretty hard. The creative divisions have kind of been stifled under Bob Chapek, and he's a bean counter. He came from parks, the Disney parks, and was really put in charge of making streaming a little bit more profitable or just trying to cut costs in a lot of ways. And he hurt the creative side because of that. But I think Disney can always rebound. They're, you know, the home of culture and a lot of our childhoods. And if they get back to the basics and the classic filmmaking and animation that they can do, I think they'll be just fine.
Now, it is hard to overlook, Dr. Draper. As I mentioned at the top of this, I'm a huge Disney fan. I'm down there probably once every 6 weeks, and I live in Connecticut, just to give you an idea. My brother's a cast member. I grew up a big Disney fan. My listeners know this. And so it's at the core of me. And a lot of times I'm approached because Disney has become more progressive in some of their storylines, whether that is adding interracial couples, whether that is making the protagonist, in these live-action films, African-American or when they used to be white, or, you know, whatever the case may be, or having more gay couples. You know, these things are brought up to me all the time by some people who are not necessarily against it, but they're like, hey, you haven't noticed that Disney's almost overcorrecting in their films. And I kind of think, well, I think that they're just moving with the times. I think they're just learning from, hey, you know, like, we need to be more open-minded. Why are all protagonists white? Why do they tend to be that way? I don't think that's a bad thing. Why do we always assume that all couples are just a male and a female when we know that that's just not the case? I don't know if that means that Disney is becoming like overcorrecting. I think that they're just moving with the times. Would you agree, or do you think that Disney is going too far in some regards with their movies and their storytelling that it's now backfiring?
No, I think when things have been the same way for a long time, any kind of change feels drastic, even though it's not when you look statistically at the number of maybe white protagonists or male-female couples compared to other more progressive situations. It's really just a drop in the bucket. So I don't think they're overcorrecting. They're making up for lost time, definitely. But it's not near as big of a change as people might think.
Well, like, Dr. Draper, correct me if I'm wrong, and this is totally fine if you don't agree, but like when Lightyear came out, for example, I thought that was so blown out of proportion. I kept looking for the scene that I can't remember which country canceled it, but I kept looking for this scene of such an inappropriate moment between a gay couple, and I'm watching it and I'm looking for it. My son didn't even notice it, and I almost missed it, if not for my husband being like, I think that was the moment. And to not even give anything away, I was like, wait, that's what we're flipping out about? Like, that to me just shows that we're super closed-minded and we're looking for trouble as a society. Because if you read news headlines when Lightyear came out, you would have thought that Disney put out, like, something totally inappropriate. And I just did not see that. I just did not see that as being what was being portrayed on the screen.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And sometimes the media and the internet in particularly can be more vocal than is actually reflects the actual population. And also some countries are just much farther behind than us in those terms. And they're just going to not allow you to release the film at all. And that's just the risk that that Disney takes sometimes. But they're willing to do that.
Dr. Draper, any other thoughts on what's happening with probably one of the biggest companies in America's history and why their animated films are just not up to par as they used to be?
Well, one big thing is their streaming service, Disney Plus. It was a great thing during the pandemic, but now that things are more normal and people are going out more, people aren't used to going to the theaters, and they're used to watching animation at home. And Disney released a number of their Pixar films straight to the streaming service, and people just don't really want to come out and pay to take the whole family, and that's really affecting people's movie-going habits and also rethinking of how much budget and how much creativity you're putting into these releases.
Well, Dr. Draper, I want to thank you again for weighing in on the conversation. And again, the name of his podcast that he co-hosts is called Off Script Film Review, The Home of Bold Cinema. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So it's interesting that this is the topic that Bob wanted to talk about this morning, which is tearing down walls. My husband and I, a few weeks ago, we went to go see this author and this public speaker. She's also a therapist. She came to our church, thanks to Bob Donovan, and she spoke to a bunch of couples and singles in the audience. And one of the things she talked about was tearing down all these different walls that we have, whether it's denial, fantasy, isolation. There are so many different ones. And she has a book that talks about it as well. So my husband and I decided after this, she was very inspiring, that we would start a book club. My husband loves to read. I'm not much of a reader. I used to be, but not so much anymore. But we decided we're going to start reading out loud to each other. So we started with Deborah's book. And we just did the chapter talking about tearing down the walls. And at the end of each chapter, she gives you questions, whether you're married or you're single. And we had probably over an hour conversation about our walls that we've either torn down. We're still working on getting those walls down. And so it is interesting. We just did that this weekend at book club, Bob Donovan. So this could not be a more fitting topic, just for me personally, but also out there in the world where we have a lot of walls built up. Good morning. Thanks for coming back on the show. How are you?
Doing great. Right. I would love to hear about that conversation. It was just an hour, huh?
It was, right? Well, to be fair, you know, this is after 14 years of being together. So we've been talking about the walls coming down for quite some time. So it's, you know, I think we're in a much better place. But if you asked me 8 years ago, it probably would have been a good 2-day conversation about pulling walls down. So, yes, it was an hour long this time, but it was really nice. It was very productive. So let's talk about these different walls, these emotional walls, just so people get an idea of what we're talking about. What kind of walls are you going to be discussing today?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think just we all have them. I mean, very few of us were raised by perfect mothers and fathers with perfect love and affirmation and encouragement. So short of that, we come into marriage with kind of a protection mechanism that protects us. That's how we see it, to protect us from being hurt. So again, Deborah uses this term emotional walls that we use are pattern of behaviors that we use to keep us, as we perceive ourselves to be, safe, primarily because of past interactions and past examples. So yeah, that's where we come into marriage with something. We really do. It's so weird that I don't know if I can name any couple, including ourselves, that really handle this really well. You know, like we actually have a little marriage group, and on Friday this came up. And so interesting that the men all had the same issue. That so one of the walls I want to talk about is the wall of withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
The wall of withdrawal, when a withdrawal is that one person feels threatened, feels unsafe with a conversation or something that happens, and they go inward and sometimes even physically withdraw. They go to a different space. So,
that's my husband. Yep. That was one of his, yeah,
well,
that was one of his walls.
Funny?
Yep.
That, again, mm-hmm. we had this little group and all the men, including me, mm-hmm. I said, in fact, I said to the guys, you know, I have a PhD in this.
it's true. Well, because, I mean, let's be real, though, Bob. I think it's because, you know, we came from generations, even my own generation, where my husband was told to stuff it. I'm going to be real. Right. I'm going to be honest. Right. My husband was not really allowed to feel in his house. And that's not a knock at my in-laws. He was raised by his grandparents. And I think, you know, he had a military grandfather who was like, listen, your emotions are nowhere near as big as some bigger things out in the world. So figure it out. And they didn't talk about emotions in his house. So absolutely, after 18 years of, okay, I'm just going to figure it out on my own. I came into the world and I entered his world. And I'm like, you got to talk to me. And he's like, nope, we don't do that. We don't talk about things.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. Our parents really didn't really know how to handle this. And we watched, again, that's how we learn, right? We watch. And then we learn. So,
yeah.
But it is interesting that I think this is a mostly a male wall. I also find it interesting that with a couple, there's usually a withdrawer and a pursuer. And it's really interesting. Not like my wife and I, that's really interesting that we're both kind of more inward. So conflict looks really different for us.
Mm-hmm.
But most couple, there's a pursuer and a withdrawer. And it's
poor
really
Derek.
Interesting.
He married
again.
The ultimate pursuer. Good Lord.
Yeah. Again, Melissa, in our group Friday, that the women were pursuers.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting, the pursuers think the more I pursue, the more likely he'll respond. And that is completely opposite to the truth.
Because
the more you pursue, the more the withdrawer withdraws. And you think about that pattern. And that's what happens. And usually it doesn't end well. And so that's kind of the pattern of the wall of withdrawals, that one person feels unsafe. So they either physically go or they go inward. And again, that's okay, but it's what's really what we tell people, and we've learned to do this, is it's okay because, we're withdrawers, so we're inward. So when are you coming back? Okay? Men also need time to process things. We are slower than women to process things. So we do need time by ourselves. But not a week.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
right. Make a set time. Come back to us.
Yeah. And what we try to tell couples is, and again, it's not, maybe it's a day. I mean, depending on the situation, but you have to agree on when you're coming back and when you see what's going on here is they're not ready to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Right. But when will you be? And that's the key is when you can figure it out for yourself internally and come back. And sometimes it's just a half hour. You just need a breather. Sometimes it's overnight that you need to figure. So that's one of the first tips of withdrawals. Again, I'm the king of withdrawals, is figure out what's going on inside and agree on what you need to do internally to come back and have a healthy conversation to get over that particular wall.
Mm-hmm. According to various studies, one of the three most common causes of divorce in America is conflict. Not knowing how to argue, and just a breakdown in the relationship. And so what are those? They're walls. They're walls that make it very difficult for us to have successful conflict, which sounds like a bizarre term, but there is such a way to have successful conflict, healthy conflict with your spouse. And so we're talking this morning with Bob Donovan, our marriage consultant, because we want healthy marriages out there. And some of the most common walls, we were talking about the wall of withdrawal, and a couple more to talk about this morning. The wall of denial. This is the one I had to break down when I entered a relationship with my husband. I won't say who because both my parents listen to this show, but one of my parents is really bad at admitting that they are wrong. I picked up that trait right away from this parent. I have been that way since I was a kid. And it wasn't until we entered your class, Bob, almost 9 years ago, hard to believe, that I realized, oh my gosh, if I always have to defend myself, if I'm always focused on me, and there's no way I could be wrong in this situation, then we are never going to move forward as a couple. I won't hear my husband correctly. I'm not going to validate him correctly. So the wall of denial, that was probably one of my biggest walls entering marriage. I could never be wrong. It was terrible.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So, yeah, Deborah has like 8 of these, and I picked 4 that I think I've seen that mm-hmm. are the most destructive. And I think this is a big one.
I think it's a huge one. I think it is.
It is.
Absolutely.
I think mm-hmm. the other ones, I think there's ways that you can learn how to interact differently. But this one here, if you have the wall of denial, which is failing to take like any ownership
any responsibility.
For your part,
mm-hmm.
any, right? Like, you're going nowhere with that.
Well, it could fail a marriage. I mean, I say it very openly because, honest to God, Bob, we're not perfect, but I'm so proud of my marriage. We've worked so hard, and we know we have to continue to work hard to keep our marriage. But there's no question. I have no problem. If you look on paper, a lot of times people will say, oh, you know, one of you has done a lot wrong. But I look at the part that people don't see on the surface and underneath, and I'm like, wow, if you look at my walls versus Derek's, I think mine are more destructive. Denial was a game changer if we did not get rid of that wall almost a decade ago. That would have, I think, destroyed our marriage, no question.
Yeah, it does. It does, mm-hmm. because, again, there's no conversation, right?
Exactly.
If I see no part in my wrongness, there's no conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny that I think these pop up. Like, I think we have some go-to walls that we use. Like, this one might be for you. Withdrawals, that one's for me. But I do think we have pieces of all these in us. Like, even for this one, like, Karen and I had an interaction a few months ago on something. And, man, I was like, convinced that I handled this the right way, and Tuesday I was like,
isn't that the worst feeling? You're like, wait, I'm wrong. This is the worst.
No, I'm trying to explain. It's like rash. I was trying to explain why mm-hmm. I did what I did, right? And then finally, she just said, "Well, it's not what you did. It's how you did it."
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Ouch.
So then,
but
it was right. That's again, that was my. I was like trying to rationalize and defend why I did. So I think we have pieces of this on occasion,
mm-hmm.
But this is a big. I'm glad you made some progress in this. I will say that even for us, Melissa, you know, it's 47 years in, we still work on these. I think you have kind of a natural predisposition to go your wall, so you have to kind of like be intentional about recognizing it and mm-hmm. trying to overcome it. You know, another one I see a lot in couples is the wall of displacement, and that's what we call transference or another term. But it's when you take out your negative emotions on your spouse, who typically has nothing to do with whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Either it's a bad day with the kids by a stay-at-home spouse, or, you know, a tough day at work, or your friend told you something that triggered something. It's something that happened or stuff that built up, and then something totally innocent happens, and you come out with negative emotions on your spouse. You displace what's going on in you towards him or her.
Mm-hmm.
I see that a lot, and typically – we're not good at handling these things, so we kind of bury them. And then when they come out, like, what happened? Where did that come from?
Yeah.
And you don't know. Like, you don't know where that came from. But I see that. I see that a lot in couples. I tell you, where it happened to me once, not in marriage, but, like, I used to coach basketball with the kids, high school kids. And one kid came to our practice. He had been drinking. And my parents were both alcoholics, so – wow, this
triggered you. Yeah.
A huge, like, I absolutely froze. Like, it triggered something. So mm-hmm. I think these happen all the time with us. So a lot of it, and the last one I'll talk about, then I almost want to take a step back and look at all these, because there's a way to deal with all this. But the wall of passive aggressive, and this was another one that I learned early on, is when you don't say what you need, and then you act aggressively when your need is not met.
Mm-hmm. You act like they're right? fortune tellers. Yep.
Yeah. Right, right. And I know Deborah, I love it. She says, you can't hold somebody responsible for something that you didn't tell them
exactly
they're responsible for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing that, and again, when I was a kid, that was me, because I was never good at expressing my needs. So coming to marriage, I just never did. Actually, it's so funny. Karen as well, like, she grew up in a house where
right.
kids are better seen and not heard. So mm-hmm. neither one of us were really good. This took a long time for us to be able to feel confident to express our needs. But when you have this wall, you don't express your need, but then you act, you know, pouty, right? And then
right.
you well, I'll show them, mm-hmm. right? You go and maybe you go someplace you don't want to go, and then you're in a bad mood or whatever it is. Or so it's
totally
another one
thrown.
That I think we learned.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I see this a lot too.
So the thing is, Bob, only because I know we're running out of time and there are so many different walls out there, and I know people can reach out to you, which we'll give them your email in a second. But if you don't mind giving us like a blanketed, how do you even begin to admit you have walls and start to pull them down a little bit? What would you suggest?
I think it actually comes down to a couple of things. One is, I think all these walls come up because we see conflict as negative. We go back to where we were as a kid and see it as negative. So Deborah uses another term called conflict reveals what needs to be healed. So understanding why you do what you do, okay? Conflict reveals what needs to be healed. Understanding why do I need to run and hide in my little space when I see conflict? So I've had to like go inward and figure out why. So one is trying to take a step back. See what you do and understand why you do what you do, and whether maybe you need to see somebody and talk through that through. I know for me, it was Deborah's book called Are You Really Okay? I actually read it over like 4 months, and it was like going to therapy with her, but it helped me reveal why I feel the need to withdraw. So I think that's a big step, is understanding what needs to be healed. I think two is a huge attitude shift on conflict. Most of us see conflict as unhealthy, negative, and it's not. It's every healthy couple needs to understand how to deal with conflict in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. So seeing conflict differently as an opportunity to make your relationship stronger is another huge step.
And Bob, I know, as I mentioned, that there are so many different couples with different backgrounds, different walls that they're trying to tear down. And some have only been together a few years. Some have been together for a few decades. So it's going to look different for everybody. But if they wanted to reach out to you, even just to get an idea of what your recommendation would be or talk about counseling or anything like that, how do they find you?
I love what you just said. You said it looks differently, and it really does. People think conflict is someone yelling and somebody's not yelling. That's not true. But not to my wife and I. So conflict looks different to every single couple. Mm-hmm. So that'd be great. It would be email bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blackrock.org.
All right, Bob. Always appreciate these conversations. Thank you so much, and we'll talk in a couple of weeks.
You're the best. Take care.
Aw, shucks, Bob. He has to say that because I don't know if any of you caught him saying it, but he definitely said my wall was the worst. So am I defending myself now? I think I am.